Okay, so after feeling like I was being squeezed very vigorously by Bill Marciano this morning, it is time for me to talk about perturbation theory for high precision lattice QCD. I'm obviously not this guy. It's not quite so funny. Peter's mother died over the Christmas holidays, so he's been obviously preoccupied with family matters since then. So despite the unhappy circumstances, I am glad to be dropped in. To try to take his place anyway, to tell you about the work of our collaboration, the HPQCD collaboration, which is really, as I'll tell you later, kind of a collaboration of collaborations. This is my talk. However, much of the vision in this talk, as is the case of the vision that underlies this collaboration, owes to Peter. And that's also true of many of the insights into lattice effective field theories that we're using during that vision. I hate these things. I actually kind of ruined my voice by teaching first year physics to large groups without using a microphone. And okay, so is that okay? Okay, so we have this vision for the possible impact of unquenched lattice QCD on, in particular, heavy flavor physics. And to turn that vision into real numbers, one, as I was saying before, relies on a number of insights into lattice effective field theories that, again, owe to Peter. So I want to tell you about two major recent developments that we think are ushering in what we like to describe as a new era in lattice QCD. And the first has to do with unquenched simulations, and one could say that within our collaboration, we don't intend to do quenched QCD anymore. It's all unquenched, and it's all supposed to be three flavors of light quarks in the C. And this has been the holy grail of lattice since the beginning, and one would want to know why we think we can do this now, and I'll try to answer that question. The main reason is that one has a new discretization of the action for light quarks, and our claim is that it's used as a formulation called stagger quarks, which I'll say a little bit about. It's long been known that stagger quarks are much more efficient computationally than other formulations. The problem has been, in the past, this kind of discretization has been plagued with poorly understood and very large discretization errors, and it's only been recently that one thinks one understands where those errors were coming from and knows how to correct them. So it's the accuracy of the staggered formulation of the light quark action that has received a lot of attention and is driving the new simulation work. The upshot of this is that one can simulate at much smaller C quark masses than has heretofore been possible. So we run at masses, say, 3 to 5 times smaller than earlier unquenched simulations. The C, U, and D masses are still rather large, but we think they're small enough that Carl perturbation theory is now accurate. The masses are small enough for Carl perturbation theory to take us into the Carl limit from our simulations. And the other thing is that we run at 2 plus 1 flavors, not 0, not 2, but at the relevant number of flavors in the C. So again, it's supposed to provide us with a reliable Carl extrapolation. And we think this reduces the systematic errors on a set of quantities, which we call gold-plated, and which I'll define later. We think this reduces errors down to the level of a few percent. And to respond to the squeezing from Bill this morning, I think that would include the quark vacuum, the hadronic vacuum polarization tensor at the few percent level with present techniques that would be in this category. And this contrasts with what we know about the large and unsystematic errors from the quenched approximation that have plagued lattice for a long, long time. So I'll present some results that we have that I think illustrate the power of this method. We're not done in terms of the work that needs to be done. Most quantities that are of interest to heavy flavor physics require perturbative matching of the lattice effective theory to the continuum. And that's currently now. We don't think of unquenching as the bottleneck. It used to be. We don't think so anymore. Now the bottleneck is the question of doing the relevant perturbation theory at the relevant order for the precision that we want. So it's the matching that is crucial for further progress. And as I'll tell you soon, we must routinely do this matching at a two-loop order. two-loop calculations are not easy in the continuum, and they're not easy on the lattice. I'm not sure if the lattice is harder to do at this order. The lattice does present you with some novel, the regulator presents you with some novel challenges. In particular, there is an algebraic bottleneck. The lattice Feynman rules for the theory are extremely difficult to write down, and one has to deal with that. One will also have to deal with what kind of infrared regulator will one use for higher order calculations, an infrared regulator that we can use both in the continuum and on the lattice to do the matching, and that's a non-trivial question, perhaps. We've made some progress, I think, on these fronts, and I was charged with trying to connect with the rest of this workshop, and so there is a possibility for bringing continuum techniques to bear, and I have at least one illustration of that, some recent work by Becker and Melnikov, to show how expertise from outside what a lattice person like I knows might help to deal with some of these issues. So our focus is really on the CKM matrix, and so we've all seen this kind of plot before, and so that was sort of the CKM matrix more or less today. On this side with theoretical uncertainties before this program that we're trying to embark upon on the lattice, and one can try to extrapolate to the future with precision input from B factories, and on this side, well, this is the kind of impact that we think lattice calculations can have in terms of shrinking down these bands in the rho eta plane, for example, and trying to help in the search for new physics. So this is really what we're focused on in our work. As I said, this is a collaboration of collaborations, and this is the first major paper from our group, and it's got lots and lots of authors on it. Again, HPQCD really, I guess, means these people up here, but I like to think of it as the whole gang. So, well, there's the HPQCD collaboration and others, and we get together from time to time to write papers with lots of authors. Not every paper in the future will have all these people on it at one time. In this case, the reason for so many people is that there are many, many things to do. So, for example, one has to generate the unquenched backgrounds that one is going to use to analyze some particular hadronic matrix element that you want. And that's been the subject of intense work by the Milk collaboration over the last few years. One has to then do the simulations of the particular hadronic quantity you want, and that's often not trivial. One has to do the Carl perturbation theory or the extrapolation, which is a non-trivial task, and then one must also do the perturbation theory matching. And as I'll try to say, this is becoming more and more the relevant thing to do, and that's really my personal involvement in the collaboration. Now, despite what we're saying about the progress that we think we've made, lattice QCD is not at the stage where it can do everything. And so, for example, it really cannot handle unstable hadrons, say the case of the rho, in a reliable way. I mean, the rho will, you're calculating the rho and it will turn into two pions and back to a rho, and these guys can fly out to the edges of your lattice, and that induces unacceptably large finite volume errors, which one is not really controlling very well. In the same way, hadrons that are, say, below threshold but very close to it can fluctuate into these some virtual state again, which is subjected to large finite volume errors. And so these kinds of things are difficult to treat. And so what we've done is try to narrow our scope to quantities where we think we can control carefully all the systematic errors. And so that means we're going to lose some things up here, but we will focus, there are states that we can focus on, so we can look at stable hadrons or hadrons that are, which are sufficiently far below threshold that this is not an issue, or very narrow hadrons where the coupling to the intermediate state is very small. And that gives us a long, long list of hadronic states that we can handle and a list that we can't. There are other restrictions. We can only do at most one hadron in the initial and in the final state. And so this means that we can do semi-leptonic decays, but at least for now, we can't do non-leptonic decays. Within this list of gold-plated, as I said, I think we would put the hadronic vacuum polarization that Bill talked about this morning in this category. And so it's not to say that other things are not interesting, but these things are interesting and they must work as you said this morning, if lattice QCD is to be trusted at all. If you can't do this, and you can't do anything. The really happy thing for the implication for heavy flavor physics is that for all of the CKM parameters except this one, there are gold-plated processes that we can use to extract the relevant hadronic matrix elements. And so that's very good news. We have this restriction, but it lets us do lots of very important physics. Okay, so here, that's the kind of summary. Here's the first part of my talk, recent progress in unquenching. And so what we do on the lattice is we do a path integral to evaluate the expectation value of some observable. And the point is, I'm telling you that we've got a new discretization for light quarks that gives us this boost in accuracy plus the speed we want. So I have to convince you that we can do this. And there are some issues to be addressed. But before I do that, let me just tell you what we've got so far in the way of physics. Well, it's important to emphasize the number of input parameters that one has to provide to these calculations. And the input parameters are the same in number and in physics as in the continuum. So they are the masses and the coupling constant, which we trade in for the lattice spacing. We do work with equal U and D quark masses, so we are cheating a little bit, but it's a small cheat, particularly for isospin averaged quantities. This should not be a large error. Okay, so we have to give up five experimental quantities to determine our parameters, and here they are. There is the input from experiment, and there is the determination of our parameters. And there's good reasons for choosing these things, outlined over here, but I won't really dwell on that. Okay, so let me stand over here for a while. Okay, so once we've got these parameters set, then we predict gold-plated quantities. And in principle, there's no wiggle room left. And so that brings us to the signature result, a signature figure in our paper. So this compares ratio of lattice QCD to experiment for nine different golden quantities. And this is the situation before. Well, there have been studies with unquenching, but let's take the typical situation of unquenched QCD and compare it with what we say is the real world, NF equal to 3 in the C. And so typically over here, one sees errors that are completely uncontrolled by the quenched approximation from 10 to 15%, depending on your prescription for things like setting the lattice spacing. People often set the lattice spacing differently for this sector as for the light quarks, or light hadrons have a different scale setting than heavy hadrons, right? That's a completely ad hoc prescription. If you just blow up that prescription, you can make the errors 20% or 25%, depending on how pessimistic you want to be. We claim now that with this unquenched study, the errors are less than about 3% for all of these quantities. These quantities check various types of physics that one wants to see that one can do with the lattice. And so, for example, we have light quark physics up here, including form factors, so prototypes for the things we want to do, you know, FB. These particular form factors were computed from partially conserved axial currents. And so we don't have any perturbative Z factors to calculate for these guys. So that's an example of picking a goal. We haven't done all the perturbation theory we need to do, but we picked something here for which no perturbation theory was necessary, and it works. Here is an example of baryons, and here's a whole whack of heavy quark states. And there's a unified treatment of heavy light and heavy mesons, the same heavy quark effective field theory, if you will, goes into the lattice simulation and does both B's and upsilons. So we feel very excited about this particular figure. The reason for the progress, we say, is that we're able to work at much smaller C quark masses. And so, for example, we work at C quark masses for U and D that are about a fifth out of the S quark mass, for example. And so that's much, much smaller than has been achieved previously in unquenched simulations. And so what that does is it allows us to do a much more accurate Carle extrapolation. And so here are the Carle extrapolations for these two states. There has been another kind of technical achievement in the lattice in recent years, which is called partially quenched Carle perturbation theory. And what that allows you to do, this is due to Lee and Sharp, it allows you to run at different valence quark masses than you actually use in your C. And that's a very old game on the lattice. Also, you have to be very careful about writing down the chiral perturbation theory for such a theory, because it actually has ghost states. And so we now know how to do that. And so that gives you more handle in the chiral extrapolation. And so, well, there's extrapolation. And the good news is that we're down at such small C quark masses that from here to here is only about a 9% extrapolation, and it's much less sensitive, for, as you would expect, for the kaon. So, this one here? Sorry. Let me, I'm sorry, I gotta get, this one here?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the central
value, everything has changed. So here's f pi quenched, and it was high by, you know, 12% or so, and it's come down. This splitting in the spectroscopy of the upsilon was low, and it's come up. This was low, and it's come by a lot, you know, and it's come up. So, I mean, I think I don't see the scatter as being the same. So this was high, it's now low. That's what you're getting at. This was low, and it's now a little bit high. I mean, okay, so I don't think you can see any evidence of fiddling or on the part of the fitting. Okay, if that's what you're intimating. Okay, that's an important question. Okay, I'm sorry I have to go through all this jazz again. Okay. Okay, so we think we do a very good job borrowing this technology for the chiral extrapolations. Just to emphasize it a little bit, here is that basically the same plot again. And so now I'll superimpose the region in which unquenched QCD used to work. And so one sees a breakdown, as one expects, for the chiral perturbation theory for quark masses that are too large. And in fact, if you could only work out here, as was in the past, you'd say, my goodness, a linear fit looks pretty good. And you'd see no evidence of the logarithms of the masses that you know are supposed to be there, but it's not revealed by your fit. And you'd zoom in, and you'd be 10% too high. So the argument then is that it's down here where we get the leverage, as it were, to improve the chiral extrapolation when that's important. Okay, so now the question, why do we have the speed up now? We've had fast staggered quarks all along. The problem, as I said at the beginning, was that there was evidence of, there were problems with the previous, what we call unimproved version of the staggered discretization. There were large errors, large discretization errors that were not really understood. And it's here where perturbation theory has had an impact in analyzing the problem and fixing it, we say. And the problem, everybody sort of knew that it had to do with the phenomenon of flavor doubling, which everybody knows about, which has been at the root of many ills on the lattice. And so just as a flash review, suppose you take a naive Dirac action and you put it on the lattice, and so there is your discretized first derivative. And in momentum space, there is a dispersion relation, and so now you know that, in fact, you have more than the single fermion you thought you put on the lattice. You have a low energy mode near p equal to zero, but you also have a low energy mode when the lattice momentum is near the edge of the Brillouin zone in some number of directions. And so you get 2^4 degenerate copies of fermions, and people used to call these flavors, but we want to distinguish between real physical flavors, U and D and S quarks, from these artifacts of the discretization, so we now call them tastes. And there's a simple trick which lets you reduce from 16 to 4 tastes. That's the staggering of the degrees of freedom, followed by a spin diagonalization. But that's really not so important to dwell on here. So you have these tastes, and this leads to completely unphysical taste-changing interactions. I mean, this degree of freedom is not present in the continuum, and so you hope that it's not going to bother you very much. But suppose you construct the hadron like a pion, and you would think of taking two soft quarks, but one of them could have a lattice momentum that's actually very close to the Brillouin zone in some number of directions, and that's also a soft mode. But this is a different degree of freedom, so this is a particular, you know, taste of pion, and it goes in, and you can have these guys annihilate into a gluon and then change the tastes. And so this was a taste for the quark, and now it's a taste for the anti-quark. And so you get mixing between one type of prion and another, and this has been studied for a very, very long time, and these mixing effects were found to be uncomfortably large. So which taste of prion do you use to calculate the prion? You know, there's a Goldstone prion, so maybe use that, but you could use one of the other ones, and there's a whole tower of them, and those splittings were large and unhappy. There was a problem also that I don't think people realize was so directly related, and that is you could calculate something in perturbation theory and so inject a low energy quark and then have it turn into a loop quark and come out again. Well, normally if you did this and emitted a very hard gluon, this thing would be massively off shell and this part of the loop integral would be very small. But this guy is very off shell, but he's effectively on shell as this one was. And so what that does is it takes that region of the loop space, which was supposed to be small, and makes it big. And this, I draw this to make it look like a tadpole diagram. Goltermann was the first to re-identify this, and he called it a quark tadpole diagram. And tadpole diagrams have a long history on the lattice. Gluonic tadpoles were at the root of problems with lattice perturbation theory that Lepage and McKenzie solved in the mid-90s. And there was one remaining problem where perturbation theory didn't seem to work, and that was for stagger quarks, and, well, this is the problem. It turns out, because this is a hard gluon, this is a purely perturbative process, and so one can use perturbation theory to remove these things, these effects, order by order. And that was the contribution of Lepage, and also at the same time, Legay and Sinclair, and so at tree level, it's very easy to do. You just modify the coupling of quarks to high-momentum gluons, and you kill off this coupling by changing the form, changing the action in a specified way. You can just kill this coupling at tree level. And it takes this other problem of stagger quarks that had been around since antiquity, large perturbative corrections, and it drops them down to what you'd expect to be the case for a good perturbation theory. And so this construction of an improved staggered action where this coupling was eliminated at tree level is what has driven the latest developments with, for example, milk unquenched simulations. We've gone beyond tree level and looked at these effects at one loop order, and we've made considerable progress in, we think, in further beating down these taste-changing interactions and really understanding that they are perturbative in origin. Okay, so I hope that conveys what the physics of the change is. The virtue of stagger quarks, nobody likes stagger quarks in the lattice. They're kind of ugly. We want them only because they preserve a chiral symmetry at finite lattice spacing. And what that does is it protects the eigenvalues of the quark matrix. The eigenvalues, if you like, are bounded by the quark mass. This can be contrasted with another very popular formulation due to Wilson, where you add a higher dimension operator that drives these doublers, these tastes, off to the cutoff. So you just get rid of them, you have no tastes, but you break chiral symmetry, comes back to you in the continuum limit, but in the meantime, it leads to an additive mass renormalization, and that can shift this thing on configurations and actually induce kind of like spurious zero modes. And those zero modes slow down your matrix inversion. You pay a very heavy price computationally for that. And that's shown in this plot. This is why we use staggered. We don't like staggered quarks, really. But they're fast. And so milk sort of operate, I guess, in this kind of teraflop year range in terms of their integrated CPU. And so you're down here for this ratio of m pi to m rho. For that comparable CPU, you'd be way, way up over here with Wilson quarks. And you'd be plagued with the difficulties of chiral extrapolations that I talked about before. Okay, so that's why we use stagger quarks. Stagger quarks are not perfect. Okay, their ugliness is not really an issue, except it makes things hard to figure out. The potential pitfall for using stagger quarks is that they come with four tastes. We don't want the tastes. We want 2+1 flavors of quarks into C. So first we want to chop out the tastes and then put in real copies for the different C quarks. And so the way you can do that is just go into your effective action and take a quarter power of this operator. And you think, my goodness, this could really rain on our parade. because this is an obviously non-local action. You first guess this has nothing to do with real QCD. You just mutilated the theory and produced non-localities that are completely unphysical. It sounds disastrous, but it's not. A lot of things have been known about the nature of this quarter root for a very, very long time. For example, there are no problems at any order in perturbation theory. This theory is the same as one flavor of QCD. The theory handles chiral anomalies correctly, which is happy. And really, ultimately, the non-localities that are there, the perturbative non-localities, the non-perturbative non-localities really actually are directly tied to changing interactions. So if you like, if there were no taste-changing interactions, then this matrix would have a set of eigenvalues, and they would come in copies of four, and they would all be the same. Every eigenvalue would have three other partners because of the symmetry of the theory. And then all you would do is, you know, you take the log of the determinant of this thing as you're waiting in the action, so you got four times too many eigenvalues, take a quarter and you're safe. So to the extent that you can control taste-changing interactions, you can beat down any problems in the non-localities. And the happy thing is that the taste-changing interactions themselves, as I tried to illustrate before, are perturbative in origin. And we have done extensive studies to demonstrate that this is true, and we think that these spurious effects are well controlled in perturbation theory. And so we think, therefore, that the non-locality is not an issue. There is one other problem. There's always a problem that that bites you. It turns out, has been known since a long time, a paper by Dash, and QCD actually has a strong CP violating phase at mu plus md less than zero. And because we basically take the modulus of this matrix before we take its root, we completely miss that CP violating phase. And we just cannot do it. However, the short answer is the real world is not in that phase. So, I mean, one might want to think some more about this than we have. We don't think that this is an issue either. Okay. Again, we don't really like Steiger quarks, and we don't like having to deal with these non-localities and worry so much about taste-changing interactions. And that worry and that perturbation theory has consumed a great deal of effort within our collaboration. But we pay that price in theoretical analysis because we get the speed that makes a difference at this point in time in terms of the physics that we think we can do. Okay, I had some other calculations and an interesting little puzzle that I wanted to talk about, but I think maybe I'll stop the first half of my talk there. So that's where we're at now in terms of gold-plated quantities. Gold-plated quantities right now are limited. The number of them is limited by the need to do lattice perturbation theory. So I mentioned F pi and FK, where we use partially conserved axial currents to avoid computing Z factors for those matrix elements. But in general, we will not have that luxury. And so we have to do the usual thing you do, and that is to match. And you know, the lattice has all kinds of crazy contact interactions that make the perturbation theory difficult. But we have to do it. And this demands a very ambitious program. And the extent of that program is determined by how big the coupling constant is at something like a characteristic ultraviolet scale at which we're doing the matching. And at the lattices that we can afford to run at, for now and for the foreseeable future, this coupling is around 0.2 to 0.3. And that means that we have to work through second order in perturbation theory in order to achieve a few percent precision. And that's not a trivial task. And in fact, very few calculations in lattice perturbation theory at this order have ever been done. And we have to do many, many of them. For every matrix element that we want to calculate, we have to do one of these things. And this is nobody's trying to minimize the difficulty of that challenge. So we have a perturbation theory subgroup. I mean, nobody really calls it that but me. There are lots of people working on perturbation theory. At the bleeding edge of this effort, I've been working with Peter and his student, Quentin Mason, who's now a postdoc in Cambridge, and my student, Matthew Gnomes. And other people, as I said, are involved. And I think we must turn our attention increasingly to this program. And so what's the problem? So in perturbation theory, one needs the Feynman rules. And so here's an example one might be interested in. One might want to convert the lattice, the bare coupling on the lattice, to some renormalized coupling, say maybe alpha MS bar. And so that will require perturbative calculation. And so forget about this diagram, which is obviously a lattice artifact, and just look at this one. Well, that's also a lattice artifact. It's a tadpole diagram, which would vanish, well, in dimensional regularization, but it doesn't vanish on the lattice. Okay, triple gluon, quadruple gluon vertex. Six terms to write down for the continuum, and here's the expression on the lattice. The final rule depends on the particular lattice theory that you use, and the theory that was used to generate this Feynman rule is the simplest gluonic action, the Wilson gluon action, that has unacceptably large discretization errors. We use an approved action, which, as I'll show you in a minute, generates a far more horrendous version of the Feynman rule. And that's for four gluons. We will need contact interactions with up to six gluons for our purposes, and that's going to have a much, much longer expression. And this page is taken from a kind of a standard introductory book on lattice field theories by Rota. And it's kind of interesting. So he says the expression is very lengthy and has been given in an appendix by a very old paper. Footnote, the expression given the above reference, however, is not completely correct. And here's the corrected form. And so, you know, I could imagine, even knowing the answer, having difficulty rederiving this thing by hand. You know, I'm certainly not going to want to do this by hand. What the complication comes from, as I think most of us know, is that we use parallel transporters to preserve gauge invariance on the lattice. And so this leads to an exponential explosion of contact interactions that we have to deal with. And so our challenge is to produce vertex functions, Feynman rules, for as many gluons as we're going to need and for all these wacky contact interactions. And so what we want is a black box which says, you put in whatever action you want into this black box, and it will be composed of some number of links, say four links for the Wilson-Plaquette, but more in our case. You want to plug this in here, and you want this thing to tell you what the Feynman rule is. You don't want to do it by hand. This is a counting problem. How many ways can you assign R labels to L entities, L ordered entities? And there is the counting. And in our case, for improved gluon actions that control discretization errors, we will have up to six links, and we will need up to six gluon lines in our contact interactions, and that's 5,000 or so terms. An additional problem is that we use many effective theories. We use an effective theory for light quarks, we use a different effective theory for the heavy quarks on the lattice, yet another one for gluons. And these actions have continued to evolve as people experiment and try to find, you know, the most accurate and reliable discretization. And so just as you finish doing your lattice calculation for today's action, along comes another one. And what are you going to do? You have to start all over again. Not if you have a thing which does the black box for you. So that black box is absolutely crucial. So in a way, this is just an annoying technical. I mean, you could say that this makes lattice perturbation theory much more difficult in the continuum. That's not really true. This is just an annoyance we have to kind of get around. And if we can't, well, then yes, it is more difficult. We can't do anything. The amazing thing is that there exists a class of remarkably simple algorithms that will do that black box. It will automate it for you. And the black box, and many of us have now, you know, well, somebody has to design the black box. Many of us have done it. It involves entirely symbolic and some numeric manipulation. And it will generate the Feynman rules for essentially arbitrarily complicated actions. So you change your action. The interface is very user-friendly. You specify to the black box in graphical form, you know, what is your new action? And then it takes it and produces the Feynman rules. This algorithm is not ours. In fact, the algorithm is very old. It's due to Lusher and Weiss, and other people have played with similar algorithms or variations. And in particular, Carl Morningstar had a very nice set of insights into this paper that I found very useful. So this is not our algorithm. What is new for us in the perturbation theory program is we will use this algorithm extremely aggressively to apply it to the most complicated actions and to work like heck to do that. So just to give you some insight into how that, I mean, it sounds completely mysterious, at least it did to me. Let's take the simplest case of what one might want to stick into the black box. And that would be a quote-unquote action whose links are pointing in just one direction, you know, summed over the lattice. And technically no trace yet, we'll do the trace later. So this thing is e to the perturbative gauge field. But for this action, I can write down the Feynman rule immediately because it's just a Taylor expansion of one exponential. And again, technically what I'll do is generate the vertex rules for this link action unsymmetrized, just so that I can keep track of ordering, and then I'll symmetrize later in a trivial way. So I've got to compute this thing as a function of the R gluon variables, momenta, spins, and colors. And so here it is. Well, because of this summation, we get momentum conservation, and we can also inject some momentum if we want into the vertex. At this order in the number of gluons, that's the order of the expansion of the exponential, so you get that. All of these gluon polarizations are constrained to be the same and to be along the direction of the link because that's the only thing we have. That's the only gauge field we have in this toy action. So this is a very Lorentz non-invariant constraint, but that's part of the complication of lattice Feynman rules. These things are parallel transporters, so you get phases that tell you that you're sitting in the middle of the two sites that you're connecting. So you get phases, which is just the Fourier transform of these guys, R of them, and then finally there's the color matrices, and that's it. There's the gluon action, the Feynman rules for this toy action. So maybe too simple to be of use, except all you now have to do is to do the Fourier convolution theorem to generate from that simple expression, which we just wrote down, the Feynman rules for any theory. And so yes, you have two link variables, you just convolute in all possible ordered ways. So it's Fourier convolution, and then you're done. We have very complicated lattice actions. Here's a heavy quark action that looks a lot like what you do in NRQCD in the continuum, except for how you handle the derivatives. How do you do this? Well, you make the Feynman rules for simple entities like the derivative, and then you convolute them to get the Feynman rules for the overall action. And that's it. That's how this thing works. How much time did you say I have? 5 minutes. Okay. So a major effort over the past year has been devoted to a third order determination from the lattice of alpha MS bar. And so here's a plot from the particle data group. And what we're aiming to do is to drop this error by a factor of about 3. This was a leading order analysis. We want to go now to next to leading order. And the way we do this in the simulation is kind of an interesting idea. So it combines a non-perturbative input. We get the scale, the lattice spacing, from some hadronic spectrum, like a spin split, or a splitting between, say, the upsilon states. So there is a non-perturbative input. And then we measure some short distance quantity. And if it's short distance, then it will have a perturbative expansion with a scale that is set by this thing. So determine this, measure that, solve for the coupling, and then evolve. This is a very old idea. I'm sorry for crushing it in so quickly. The charge to the lattice perturbation theory people is to derive this connection so we can make the conversion through second order, next to leading order. And actually, the Wilson loops have to be done through three loops. They actually, their leading order piece has got a loop in it. So how you count loops is maybe a bit arbitrary, but well, it's got three loops in it. The coupling constant matching is a standard thing that we do using a background field technique, and I'll just mention this slide because Keith Ellis is sitting over here. We have to do the continuum. Somebody has to do the continuum side for the matching. We're going to do the lattice side, and this goes back a long, long time. Surprisingly, the fermionic loops haven't been done until, well, we did it along with these guys. Here's an example of matching, well, the Feynman diagrams that one has to calculate for the matching of the coupling constant, fermion loops. And so there are the four diagrams in the continuum, and here are the extra guys on the lattice, generated by all those wacky contact interactions, of which there are plenty, and those. And then there's a whole whack of additional diagrams from the gluonic side. So it is a large calculation. We also have to do next-to-next leading order Wilson loops, and that has a whole pile of diagrams as well. And I hope this is reasonably clear at the end. We put all these things together, and out comes our answer soon. Okay, this spring for sure. We have a number, but we have to think about it a little more. Okay, we're doing other things. Let's just go past all of that. And I'll try to end with challenges and open problems. One challenge is that for the matching, you know, we have to do the continuum side. And well, you know, we can do it, but other people can and maybe are more expert, and there's lots of matching to be done for the future. One might want to look at continuum techniques for actually doing the loop integration. There's a loss of Lorentz invariance and very complicated integrands. And your first guess because of this is that traditional techniques from the continuum are not going to help you to evaluate these integrals. Well, we actually do them by brute force numerical integration. That's one answer. But this is going to die at some point. Brute force numerical integration may not be able to capture disparate scales. Say there's the hard ultraviolet cutoff, and then there's some soft scale. And just integrating numerically, it might not be able to get out those different scales, although in the problems we've done so far, it does work, just doing it brute force. Despite this, however, there are techniques that can be brought to bear from the continuum, and that's the subject of some very nice papers by Becker and Melnikov. And finally, there's this question of infrared regulators. For most of the processes where we want to do the matching, there's an infrared divergence. Almost all lattice perturbation theory to date has used the gluon mass as the regulator, which is only okay at one loop. We're going to two loops. We have to have a regulator. And there's a very nice regulator due to Hotuft that's coming to us from the continuum using what are called twisted periodic boundary conditions. And they actually provide a gauge invariant infrared regulator, although they may make the continuum calculations. They do make it harder. But we have looked at this some. I guess I'm really done. I'm sorry. My apologies to Kirill and Thomas. They have this very clever method for trying to separate the scales in some lattice integral, capturing the soft scale, which you want to get those logarithms very carefully, using continuum-like methods. This is a very nice bit of work, and they've applied it to a very complex problem. Okay, I'm just going to skip over this. This is a very cool subject, but it's probably too technical, and time is short. Okay. My apologies for rushing. So here's the summary. Unquenched lattice QCD, well, that's all we're going to be doing. NF equal to 3 in the C. And we claim that few percent precision is now possible, at least for gold-plated quantities, which includes a lot of very relevant physics. However, most of those things will require perturbative matching, and that's the key to further progress. Happily, there are automated methods which will allow us to do that, although it will be hard. We have already done some important two and even three loop calculations for the relevant situation. And we anticipate two loop results this year, spring for this and summer for those guys. And ultimately, two loop hadronic matrix elements for the CKM matrix. And just as on a more speculative note, in terms of a broader connection to collider physics, lattice gauge theories themselves may be of broader import if it turns out that new physics ends up being strongly coupled. So in a way, one can think about taming these problems now for QCD as a prototype for other strongly coupled theories that one might want to have to deal with. Okay, that's the end.
We have time for a few questions.
What's the status of moments of structure functions in the proton?
Short answer, I don't know. Sorry.
Actually, a related question. I mean, we know that the status is not that good in unpolarized. It was a 40% departure between experimental value and the lattice results. Now you come up with this new method of staggered fermions, and I think what one could expect in the foreseeable future would be certainly a high precision of 3%, perhaps. when time will come, and certainly one needs computational time and computers for this. But there may be also other things which are very interesting, which were, for instance, mentioned by James Stirling. The question is S equal S bar in distribution? What is the flavor splitting of the C in the polarized and unpolarized proton and things like that? So I just would like to see, we should have simulations of that type with the Staggett fermions very soon, also in the structure function community.
Maybe. Yes, I mean, this is outside the area that I know well. I think what you say is true, that this would fall into the gold-plated category. But I'm a little bit ignorant.
There are methods to compute perturbative, to make perturbative calculation on the lattice, which are numerical.
That
is, use a Gaussian distribution. Why you cannot apply these methods here?
Yes, actually, I didn't mention that at all. That is another component of the work that we've done and that I've been involved in, and there are other groups. There is a possibility of doing perturbation theory numerically, as you say, and there are several essentially, well, different but equivalent techniques. Those methods have the virtue that they require much less, if any, analytical effort. And so that was the subject. I mean, it's a little, maybe if I just have a second, I'll put up a graphic that while I'm talking. Okay, so if I just look at this graph, I mean, this path integral encodes the entire content of the theory, including its perturbative content. And so one can just send the lattice spacing to be very, 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 very small in a finite box, for example. And then for a finite box with very, very small lattice spacing, that's an entirely perturbative theory. And so one could just, in our approach, one could just measure an observable in this perturbative regime and run at several different values of the coupling and fit to a perturbation series expansion for this thing. That's one way. And there are others. And that, as I said, has the virtue that it requires essentially no analytical manipulation. There are other technical problems, as one might expect, that one has to address, which we think we have. And in the beginning, this was where we were spending most of our effort, because I guess we were a little bit afraid of the analytical perturbation theory. But we're not so afraid of it anymore. So the analytical method has taken over in importance within our collaboration, although we still are working on this kind of numerical method, as are others. So I think they're equivalent. In fact, we've used results from both methods as cross-checks that the answer we get is correct. Okay.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank all the speakers.